Good morning. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some works today that I've done over the past 30 years working in this field. I work from California. I work both as an artist and a writer, which I consider two sides of a single practice. I was asked to speak a little bit about the some of the kind of ideas that inform this work that you see today that have come from, I guess, basically the past 35 years. Reflexive inquiry is a distinguishing feature of what we might call socially engaged or new genre public art. This practice is an art on the edge of art, on the edge of non-art, and defining its meaning is a particularly important activity within the total project. Today, those definitions are formed by both theorists and artist practitioners, such as myself, working in both writing and the field. For me, it's questions that lead the practice, and reflection adds substance to it. In the beginning, we deconstructed public space, forms of analysis, functionality, and the art world itself. But as Simone mentioned, although Rosalind Krauss was not really formative for the work that I did and my colleagues, rather Alan Caprow and Joseph Boyce were the people that we were listening to, because we did not come, strictly speaking, from a sculptural vantage point. Many of us came as activists from the field, and we worked with social justice and equity issues. So since the time is short, and I've done a lot of work in each project, like the two that Superflex showed, take years, and I think that is a hallmark of this work, the sort of labor intensity of it. I'm only going to show some images and mention briefly a couple of works, because I wanted to balance that and was asked to balance that with some general observations about the field as it stands now and questions that I'm engaged with. So in the beginning of the 70s, public space was in fact seen as quite unified, and coming from the left, working class, from communities of women and communities of color in the United States, it was seen as a unified whole that we wanted to disrupt, interrupt. We were in that era of the beginning of performance, the materialization of the object, capitalism, and art commodity. Within that context, we chose transience as a political act. We acted in probably with a whole lot more antagonism toward the gallery structure, the museum structure, than is evident today in the works of younger artists. Naturally, moving into the public sphere, I remember as I started working on violence against women, you have to remember a time when that was not a subject that was part of polite discourse, and it certainly was not a public subject. And yet images from pornography in the mid-70s were beginning to creep through into mainstream media, and we felt like we needed to basically begin to make interruptions into that media stream and re-educate both media makers and the general public to the kind of authority of women's voice within that field of violence. So as we moved into the public, those audience members who were working class women, who were people who would never step foot inside a gallery, began to be conceived more of as our audience, and or that opened up the notion for us of to conceive them as collaborators, which brought up a host of problems later. But we were in this sort of heady era of the democratization of art, where we were saying that, yes, women could be makers, artists of color could be makers, as could working class people. So that in the U.S., and particularly in that hotbed of liberalism in California, the work we speak of at this in this conference, I would say, took its shape through the agency of women and so-called ethnic minorities. It was informed by media theory, people such as George Gerbner, critical pedagogy, people such as Paolo Ferrari, activism, Abby Hoffman, and, as I said, the kind of artist theory by people like Caprow and Boyce. As much later, Lars von Larsen said, if you want to mess with the stability of categories, you must also accept that the category and the institutional practices of visual art may end up being restrictive. And in that era, that is precisely what happened. There was no welcoming biennales for this work. So it took place and grew up largely in a site-specific and community context within discourse by political people as opposed to artists, although artists were very much part of this discussion. So briefly, I'm going to show you a work from this time called In Mourning and In Rage, and it was specifically an attempt to intervene in the media coverage of the Hillside Strangler murders, which was going along according to a fairly conventional narrative within which sex violent murders are generally, you know, there's sort of assumptions about who the killer is and who the women are and so on. And there is, in the United States, no political analysis of this. In fact, today that is the case as well. So we set up an organization called Ariadne, a social art network, which was a conscious and tactical self-institutionalization. It was a collaboration between media makers, activists, sociologists, psychologists, lawmakers, and artists over 3 years to basically introduce pedagogic works into the public to change their point of view about violence against women. In this project, In Mourning and In Rage, there was about, there was 10 women who had been killed by this time by the Hillside Strangler. We staged this event at City Hall in Los Angeles to make a media incursion into media stream. And these 10 women who represented looks like that one's stuck. Somebody can get that. These 10 women who represented the 10 victims of the Hillside Strangler were standing on the steps of City Hall, and as all the media assembled, we constructed a media coverage that would go as we constructed it into the media, and in fact it did. It was covered by as far away as Paris on this project. And then we spent another month educating people to the, including going on the media and talking to people about how they might want to reconsider their coverage, which was according to some very stereotyped, typical conventions. So rather than, while we're waiting for that, I'll tell you some of the things from this era that I am now working with today or considering. I want to recuperate some of these notions implicit in the practice for continuing consideration. The first is strengthening the community or the publics. And again, as this is a community-sided practice, we were very concerned with, and still today, can this kind of strengthening take place outside of a lengthy period or substantial commitment of time in the community? And second, this notion of power, authority, and transparency. Because we were working with mixed racial communities, we got very engaged with who is doing the speaking and who could speak for who. Third, the notion of functionality and the traditions of service. How does work work, and to what end do we work? And finally, as you begin to get larger and larger, and you'll see as I go through some of the years of this work, it becomes more and more embedded in large-scale social structures and institutions. I think the question is, how do we impact policy and change over time and embed our work within the institutions and policies? So let me catch up with this work, where we brought politicians out to align themselves, again, with a cause that was not really spoken about in public. That one just doesn't seem to be working. Yeah, I'm not sure why. Many of these works began to develop the kind of pedagogical structures that you see today. We incorporated, as operating in the model of performance, we incorporated sort of the notion of the beginning, the middle, and the end, the workshop, the news conference, the engagement with City Hall. We sort of incorporated all of that as part of an expanded performance. We used maybe you should just stand there and click that one. Yeah. We define ourselves as ed workers working at the boundaries of art, between art and popular culture, between communities of difference. Practice became research-oriented, ethical, dialogic, pedagogic. And I was interested to read recently Simone's word, a proliferation of formats, models of display, and curatorial work combining self-authorization with institutional critique, tactical employment of other spaces, became a diverse and differentiated practice. I think those words apply equally well to that era as they do now. Some images again, involving thousands of people, and scale became a very important part of the work. So now 10 years later, I began to work with notions of tableaus and work in broader social scales with projects that took place over maybe a year or two, sometimes three, and engaged all the facets of the city in a conversation. And in some of this work, there was also threaded through it the notion of cohesiveness. There was a strong desire to represent utopian models in the now creation of expanded spaces for discourse, for recognition of people who were considered externalized from culture. As the understanding of multiplicity in publics grew, we also looked towards social reconciliation. For example, in this time in the mid-80s, the image of older women was the least seen image on television. So embarking upon this project in San Diego, this is another project with youth in Finland, a project with young women at a live construction site in Vancouver, a recent project in Taipei with teenagers, and finally this project on the crystal quilt, where we took 3 years to work throughout Minneapolis to develop around using a public one-hour performance as a way to challenge the discourse, change media, and the media conversation, just hundreds of events and seminars and classes and so on. These art spaces became moments of a briefly unified public in symbolic settings. This is the Crystal Court in Minneapolis, the symbolic part of the city, working with Miriam Shapiro, who designed the space, and then finally, 2 years later, on the eve of the performance, hauling in 600 chairs and putting together a large floor pattern, installing hundreds of speakers in the balcony, and setting the table for a Mother's Day performance of 400 and I think it was about 430 or 480 women who came from throughout the state of Minnesota. There were sort of three tiers of audience, a live television production of this project, and the crystal quilt was the resulting performance. And I won't go into that now, but there's, you know, power documentaries and lots of TV coverage and so on about those. Usually in a longer talk, I show those some of those works. So this briefly unified public was really utopian in its vision. It did raise the level of discourse around the issue of women, and not older women as people who remember a time past, wasn't it wonderful, but more the position of women as leaders, working with the Humphrey Institute Leadership Program to define that. And transforming this public space as a site for multiple simultaneous real-time discourse. As the scale increased, finding common ground with and deeper positioning with respect to the communities became more important than perhaps other positionings. with respect to the art world, working in these kinds of public spaces in turn influence the practice. In many ways, sight obviously changes audience. There are 3,000 people in this audience, not counting the television coverage. Sight also allows for exploring different forms of the dialogic. It also necessitates increasing skills for media and political savvy and learning how to negotiate public systems. And it also demands more meaningful results. This is now a space called Full Circle, interrogating the gendered notion of space and radically regendering it in Chicago as one develops broader and broader collaborations. As I said, in America, it's inevitable that notions of authority will begin to come forward because of the complexity and the racial diversity of our country, and the fact that early on, community got constituted around notions of race, and a white person working with people of color has been deeply and should be deeply challenged. So in this project, we've developed the notion of transparency, which is building into the project the relationship of authority. And in my works, in this project, there was a group of women specifically chosen from the different geographic sectors of Chicago, representing different races and economics and so on. And they selected 100 women to make monuments to, and we brought these boulders in from Oklahoma and took two big Mack trucks, put bronze plaques on each of them representing one of the selected women, and dropped them all over the streets of Chicago late one night. And this work generated quite a bit of controversy in the media and raised, as you could see, one after the other, as you walk down the steps of the Loop, the streets of the Loop, it began, the Chicago Loop, which is sort of an inner city core there, it began to generate the question of not only who these women are, but why they were there, and what was the public surround and the existing public's monuments in Chicago, which at that time had, I think, one work of art within the entire city by a known woman artist. So this was surrounded by, this is probably the longest work I've done. It was a 3-month installation, and it was surrounded by media coverage and lots of sort of public events honoring the women, and became part of Chicago's sort of ongoing culture. The discussion, I want to just point out on, when reduced to its essence, engaged art is frequently a process of collective making, often instigated by an artist who to one degree or another does not have the same experience as that community. And so in the United States, within the political circles that people that make this kind of art, the discussion on insider and outsider, which I think is highly relevant to us as artists and as we relate this work back to the field, the conversation on risk, privilege, and resources is one echoed in civic discourse but often evaded in the arts. Where once imagination was sufficient passport to the representation of another's experience, now empathy is challenged as insufficient motivation for art making. In the U.S., it's virtually impossible for makers working cross-racially not to encounter some form of critique based on identity. This next project is in Medellin, Colombia, and it brings up for me some of the agonistic issues that Simone talked about. This is a very highly conflicted community. I was invited by a group of anthropologists and historians to work with them in a small barrio in the middle of Medellin called Barrio Antioquia. And one of the things about this publicly engaged work is that strategies grow out of actual field negotiations, and the strategies of the work are drawn from the public engagement itself. For example, the notion of multivocality, the pluralism of styles of presentation, and the postscript-like conversations are aesthetic evolutions developed through confrontation and resolution of conflict during the making. The aesthetic and simultaneously political negotiation of differences in experience and the ways experiences is represented is more volatile when focused on inequity. And it produces what I would call it an evolving, rough-edged, and imperfect art form that is particularly adept at modeling civic discourse. And as a result of my work, I was invited to do this. This Barrio Antioquia is affected, as is all of Colombia, by multiple and complex violences, armed political conflict between guerrillas, the army, the paramilitary, organized crime that is part of the drug trade, territorial violence among militias and youth gangs, and everyday criminal and domestic violence. On my first day in Barrio Antioquia, as I was driving down the street, I saw a dead teenager who had just been killed in a shootout. One of the young people we worked with had his arm replaced when he was shot in the arm, and it developed infection. I was told that in Barrio Antioquia, there are places you can walk and places you cannot walk. This map must be engraved in your memory. The streets are similar to the center. The streets are the center of a rich and dynamic cultural life, but they are also, for years, they hold the homes of people who the next door neighbor may have killed your nephew. So there's long-standing conflict in this community and a lack of civic relationship, and the people that I was working with wanted to promote that. They're anthropologists who work very differently than in the United States. They work actually in community, and so they practice a form of subjective research where they engage themselves in the same way an artist might. So these memories of grief and anger have created territorialities that make Barrio Antioquia a problem in terms of where to place a public work. One person's street was another person's danger zone. There are few collective opportunities to mourn there, and much of the research by the anthropologists had demonstrated that the opportunity to collectively grieve created a more commodious social space, and that old grievances could be set aside in that context. So we created, using place as a metaphor and also place in memory, we created a museum that moved, like the buses that moved from one barrio to another through Antioquia. It was a fractal portrait of the barrio in all its history and complexity. It was called La Piel de la Memoria, the skin of memory, and it was a sort of notion of a moving museum. We collected over the course of 6 months with a team of people from the barrio paid through the project. These people on the left are the anthropologists and historians. We collected a series of objects that represented the memory of a loss or other kinds of memory. We weren't restrictive, but they went from door to door of the 2,000 family barrio, and they collected over 700 objects. We then constructed inside this bus a sort of a museum, and on the outside, these are the locations that the museum would move to every 3 days, moving to a different place, so that it would eventually be safe for all to enter. And these are some of the objects that range from the historical, that's money from the United States. There's a huge relationship between Barrio Antioquia and the West Coast. And various kinds of, kitsch items, including probably the most dramatic were the children that have been killed as a result of violence in this small 2,000 family community. And these are some of the young people who both collected the objects and became spokesperson and docents in the museum as it went from place to place over 10 days, and then went from that to the center of Medellin, where it was televised by lots of documentaries and stuff. It represented the barrio, which had a very negative attitude, in a positive way to the outside world. Now finally, I want to finish with a series of projects in Oakland, California. eventually this work took me to the edge of trying to understand what could art really do in any kind of substantive and long-term way for changing culture. Much can be said about this, but I decided in 1990 to begin working with young people in Oakland, California, a very mixed race environment, as a way to test out the body of this work. And I think I probably took it about as far as I could take the notion of working in an engaged way with public systems without it completely disappearing as art. And so that becomes an issue now, or a consideration for me, is what happens when you move up to the edge of art and the work then moves into the world in a way that it could be said to disappear. So as negotiativity intensifies, one gets more and more serious, engaged with the results. When working deep over time, there's a mandate for the that issues from the community. And in Oakland, working with a cross-racial group of people, it's 50% Black in the city, and I lived there for 10 years and did this work. But even though I lived there, I was still in many ways other to the teenagers that I worked with. As former connections to materiality decayed, we looked to more ephemeral and publicly located processes as what we would call the new materiality. We began to grapple with civic institutions and processes as sites and venues, as materiality, and as content. When art disappears, what results? Is there an image? Does the intent remain? Is there a document that's shown to the art world? Is there measurable change? Are there new publics? Is there a deeper respect? Are there new institutions? I think artists answer these in a variety of ways, but to one degree or another, I think we're all concerned with this. So the questions, as I said, that I was really concerned with in this work was, can a non-art institution, such as a police department, accommodate in an ongoing way the arts? And can how far do we go in these institutions without becoming program designers and managers? During the 1990s, the growing population of youth of color in the United States, youth activism and a political administration sympathetic in Oakland to the needs of young people, created an opportunity for us to work with civic leaders on public agendas. If you'll remember, the early 90s was when youth culture as a concept, largely inspired in America by African-American youth, became a vogue. But at the same time, it was used in various marketing ways within advertising and popular culture, and movies started coming out. It was also used, particularly in places like California, as a political football, so that the crime, the teen pregnancy, the lack of schooling, and so on, which really represented a kind of decaying social system, was laid at the feet of young people, and particularly young people of color, and there developed quite a bit of fear and public policy that developed around that. So these projects were situated in institutional context. I had an office in the city hall. I could work with the mayor, he called meetings for me. I worked with the politicians, all the city council. I worked with the police chief, and so on. Two police chiefs over 5 years supported a series of art productions, and our access to officer time and equipment was considerable. In the last project, you'll see police helicopters and squad cars and so on, almost like a Russian constructivist reenactment. But all of these pieces were framed around the notion of young people's multiple voices in a public center reframed by the art. There was a good deal of media coverage. This one, The Roof is on Fire, was covered with an hour documentary and covered by all the local and some national television. This is a project on teen pregnancy that involved a 6-week summer art program for young women. This is a project called No Blood, No Foul, a performance as a basketball game. And the final project, which I'll talk about a little more in depth, was Code 33 in 1999, with over the course of 2 years, with workshops and so on for young people, police youth encounter groups, media conversations, civic City Hall, you know, presentations and so on. We ended with this performance called Code 33, and it featured 200 teenagers and 100 police officers on the rooftop of a downtown parking garage. And downtown is where people still don't go because it's seen as a hangout for teenagers and a slightly dangerous place at night. These are the young people going up to the top of the roof and the sort of protest crowds and so on. About 3,000 people came to this. On the perimeter of the roof were videotapes made by young people from 8 different communities talking about violence and safety and so on in their communities. And on the rooftop, over an hour in progress, were these small groups, which were mildly mediated. The sun went down, the groups got a little less contentious, and as they continued to talk, and then finally, we restructured the community as part of the work by taking the audience down to another floor, where a mentorship table and various forms of engagement, the internet that we created and so on, you could interact with. And these are people from the 8 different communities sitting in these different little pedestals talking about the way in which youth and police engage in their community and how can they be empowered. And I'm going to just close by showing you briefly about a 3 or 4 minute video, because I think in all of this work it's really much more important to hear this evidence of the multiplicity of the projects.
Teenagers have had incidents where the cops abuse their power.
I don't understand why you would feel comfortable talking to a police officer. I just don't understand.
I mean, even before I became a cop, I grew up in Alabama. You talk about racist police officers, we got them. He's still down there. Okay, when a police officer...
Why? Why can't they get him off the force? Well, if they're racist, then why do you guys even let them break up?
Why are they bad cops?
I mean, if I'm innocent walking down the street, I would be upset too. The police put handcuffs on.
And that has nothing to do with what I'm talking about.
Why do you think you keep getting stuck?
Because I'm getting, man, I'm panicking, man.
Teenagers have had incidents where the cops abuse their
shot down. Now, because you're a cop and because you made a mistake that I was reaching for something, and because you ran my name and 4 years ago, I have something on my record. I got shot and it's okay. You may not even lose your job. That's how you're going. And you can't, and you have to admit that.
Let me give you an example. A decorated cop, right? 15 years in the force, kicking ass. The whole 15 years
kicking
he's on.
Ass the whole 15 years.
Meaning he's been making, hey, that's right. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a good cop. I didn't say he was doing anything against him. I'm talking about a good cop. 15 years on the streets, all right? Everybody knows him. Everybody likes him. The department citizens, like, he goes out there and makes a mistake like that. What do you think should happen to him?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah.
That's your attitude, though. Hey, that's what I thought. That's what I thought. A good cop like that that probably has 10 more years on the streets, he makes one freaking mistake. That's how people are. Screw him. Get him out of there.
15 years on the street, kicking ass, whatever, right? He makes one mistake, but we're on the streets, and we make one mistake. What happens to us?
Make one mistake, meaning what? One mistake about what? 25,
you ahead.
I don't understand.
Young people break the law, they don't get a second chance.
That's not true.
We just got the we got your lecture on a case where a guy just paroled after doing what 3 years for murder. Okay. So there are second chances.
I think that just shows a little respect, a little trust.
Did you ever have a mentor?
Mentor, right?
Like somebody that you looked up to or somebody that helped you out?
Yeah, yeah. Matter of fact, this guy was, yeah, he's a cop. His name is Today. Yeah, he'd be helping me out and so stuff. I think that's cool because there are not too many cops in the world.
I grew up in South Central Los Angeles, and some of the same things that the young adults are bringing up today are some of the things that I went through when I was a kid. And there was a police officer that pulled me to the side and pretty much kept me out of trouble.
I was amazed at what a lot of these kids as students in schools, you know, struggling to do halfway well, face in getting through a day.
Where do we go from here? Yeah. Because again, it's just dialogue right now. What are the solutions going
to
be?
Community has to be involved. This can't be a belief for
right,
you.
Exactly.